about free speech and community media. And so we've invited him back to talk to us some more. And just want to give you a little introduction to who he is. My dad was born on Valentine's Day in 1937. He was born and raised grew up in Denver at South High School. He graduated from there, then went on to the University of Colorado, and then received his law degree from Denver University. In 1977, he was the first, through a merit selection process, a nonpartisan process, to be appointed to the federal bench to serve on the United States District Court. He's a senior judge. He's a scholar of our Constitution. He travels around the world. He helps people write countries emerging from dictatorships write constitutions. And he's also an outspoken critic of the United States war on drugs. He's not afraid at all to talk about that. Not afraid to joke with you, and not afraid to take your questions. So it's going to be a very interesting talk tonight. When he was at Boulder, his great love was for theater, and actually just wanted to be a drama critic. Ended up in law school and going down the road of being a federal judge instead. And on his way over, he was talking about driving through the Glenwood Canyon, which was a case that landed up in his courtroom, and ended up being an award-winning, internationally award-winning stretch of highway that had a number of people all fighting about how things needed to be. And one of the things that Dad was talking about was that he refused to dismiss the case. And in refusing to dismiss it, made everyone come to the table. And that's part of why it won so many awards, was because it was this inspiring collaborative project where people got rid of their agendas and really came to the table and made something work. And you see the results when you drive through Glenwood Canyon through the I-70 corridor anytime you go that way. And it happens to be one of the cases he's the very most proud of. And I said, well, that's perfect, because we are really looking collaboration in the eye big time at KVNF. So be interesting to know about that. Dinosaur National Monument, he rode horses around there to try and figure out what needed to happen and whether or not that needed to become a monument. Glenwood Canyon, walked that canyon from beginning to end. The Colorado prison system ended up in his courtroom, and he went into the prisons to figure out how to decide what the case really was about. And in a nutshell, what he's saying is you just can't make up your mind by reading a book or being in a courthouse. You have to get out of that and walk out into the real world of human beings and try and understand what is really going on in people's lives and what the dynamics of law are all about, contrary to a lot of inflamed rhetoric these days. It is a living, breathing document, our Constitution. And I'm very proud to introduce to you my father, a very accomplished federal judge, to speak to you tonight about sin, liberty, and the law, John Cain.
That's good. Thank you. It should be blatantly obvious that I'm very, very proud of my daughter. When I became a United States District Judge for the District of Colorado 35 years ago, I approached my new life as a judge with eager anticipation. As an attorney, I had focused on trial practice with a special interest in First Amendment issues, though economic reality made me spend much more time on construction cases, commercial disputes, and an occasional criminal case. I paid close attention to the Supreme Court decisions in constitutional law, particularly freedom of speech in the press, the law of libel and defamation, and the so-called right of privacy. It was, so to speak, my passion. I was privileged to represent radio and television stations, a couple of newspapers, a movie theater operator, a film distributor, and a wire service. I developed close relationships with some of the more eccentric people in our society, generally referred to as journalists. It takes an exceedingly tolerant interpretation of that word journalist to call some of them journalists, but similar to those who became political junkies, I was a First Amendment groupie. I must confess, however, that I represented only one defendant in an obscenity case. The movie theater operator had exhibited the uncut French version with English subtitles of Bernard Bertolucci's Last Tango in Paris, which was alleged to be pornographic and therefore obscene. An American edition had been severely edited to meet the censor's demands and was rated R. Trying to save money on exhibition fees, my client obtained a copy of the uncut French version rather than having to pay a distributor for the American edition. Because my client also owned and operated a small string of radio stations, he was concerned that a conviction might result in his loss of his broadcaster's license, a far more important consequence than any fine that could have been imposed for exhibiting the film. He wasn't in the business of showing porno movies. Because of its R rating, he did not regard Last Tango as an X-rated film, but rather as an art film by an Italian director. I remember him plaintively asking me, "Who would have thought that watching Marlon Brando have sex could get me into this much trouble?" I wish I could tell you that my brilliant arguments swept my client to victory, but like most cases, we settled out of court with a dismissal and a promise that my client would not show dirty movies ever again. In its way, the settlement was an effective form of censorship, but not a shameful one. I want to talk to you briefly now about sin. Censorship has been with mankind far longer than the word we use to describe it. Not all restrictions are negative or bad. Military censorship is well taken, especially when people such as Geraldo Rivera broadcast the exact location of our combat troops. In World War II, we lived with the censorious slogan, loose lips sink ships. Removing the blueprints of banks, jails, and nuclear plants from the internet doesn't trigger a deep sense of deprivation or infringement of the right to know. Child pornography, which I will address later, is much more than an illegitimate form of expression. But when we come to ban books, the tide turns and we speak of political repression, violation of individual rights, invasion of liberty, and mindless regulation. The term censorship dates from about 440 BC when the Romans appointed two officials called censors to conduct the census and preside over the registration of citizens for the purpose of determining what taxes and other duties were owed to the community. Those duties included speaking well of the governors and not speaking ill of the state. Writings easily fell into the ambit of the censor's authority. The use of censorship to enforce respect for the ruling class and prevent riots and public disturbances went along without much controversy until Christians took control and the late Roman Empire saw the emergence of a persecutory mentality used to ensure the church's authority over secular as well as religious activities. Shortly after Constantine the Great converted to Christianity, the empire began to impose personal beliefs by the sword. What had previously been confined to ecclesiastical notions of sin became crimes. Faith was used to bolster ambitions for empire, with the result that orthodoxy and heresy became essentially matters of power politics. Constantine was willing to let the people of the empire exercise the freedom to choose their religion, but his successors were not so tolerant. 100 years after Constantine, the Christian emperor Theodosius II took the logical step of banning pagans and heretics from the imperial army and obliging all of his soldiers to participate in Christian worship. Inevitably, books and tracts by apostates, heretics, and pagans were destroyed and banned. Only the official truth was permitted. Religion had been a matter of personal preference, but gravitated into a political obligation where the church and the state were one. The neglect of religious obligations would be more than sinful, it would be treasonous. The book most often banned in Western civilization in its various iterations is the Bible. During the reign of Henry VIII, that celebrated man for all seasons, Sir Thomas More, was instrumental in having dissidents burned alive for daring to translate the Bible from Latin into English. With the merger of church and state, belief took on the force of law. Sin, defined as an act that violates a known moral rule, meant that belief, however internalized it might be, would be policed. And what better way to secure belief than to require it to be expressed? On the other hand, what better way to prevent dissent than to prohibit its expression? Colloquially speaking, any thought, word, or act considered immoral or alienating from the orthodox or majority belief could be termed sinful. Thus, sin was considered rebellion against or resistance to the direction of authority, which was officially divine. With this merger of the divine with the secular, sinful words and deeds became criminal as well. It is interesting to note that it is the expression and not the commission of the sin that receives the law's attention. As the First Amendment scholar Charles Rimbar has suggested, consider the seven deadly sins. Legislators do not prohibit fast food outlets or all-you-can-eat buffets that provide more than ample facilities for gluttony. Television provides constant opportunities for sloth. Gathering assets and ostentatious wealth stimulates envy. Wall Street investments in derivatives and tax breaks for the rich do a good job of promoting greed. And what are fashion magazines doing other than catering to pride? Admittedly, we do outlaw road rage. But what else does professional wrestling do but make a spectacle out of anger and revenge? The only one of the seven deadly sins ubiquitously opposed by governments is lust. And for the most part, certain novels have been banned because they were determined to be obscene. Uniquely in the law, it is the idea rather than the act that is proscribed as unusual, as sinful. One can think or write about money or food or idleness without penalty, but not so with eroticism. The term obscenity, derived from the Latin obscenus, meaning foul, repulsive, or detestable, means any statement or act which strongly offends the morality of the time. The term also applies to an object that incorporates such a statement or displays such an act as, for example, sculpture, paintings, photographs, and videos. The expression of obscenity is prohibited without any requirement of harm to anyone. On the other hand, the term pornography was cobbled together and has an entirely different meaning. First used in 1858, it combined the Greek words for prostitute and writing. Its intended use is to describe any writings or pictures that stimulate sexual excitement or erotic behavior. Now let me tell you about liberty. Censorship in the United States extends to children's literature, textbooks, and other educational materials, adult literature, music, art, theater, film, television, the news media, and indeed the internet. In colonial times, sex and earthy comments about it were tolerated, but writing about it was fiercely condemned. Early American censorship had more to do with preventing people from telling the truth about politicians than with being bawdy. It took a while for them to focus on sex. Mary Hull observes in her reference handbook, Censorship in America, that one of the earliest cases involved John Peter Zenger. Zenger was imprisoned in 1734 for publishing a satirical commentary in the New York Weekly Journal concerning the New York governor's pocketing of probate fees. Not that it would happen today, but Zenger could not find a lawyer in all of New York to defend him. Zenger hired Andrew Hamilton of Pennsylvania, and the jury acquitted him, thus giving us that memorable expression, "It takes a Philadelphia lawyer to get that guy off." The First Amendment, which protects the freedoms of speech, religion, and the press, as well as the rights to assemble and to petition the government, was added to the Constitution in 1791. Yet 7 years later, in 1798, Congress passed the Sedition Act, which prohibited people from criticizing the government. The Sedition Act was designed by President John Adams and his Federalists to suppress opposing political parties. The act clearly violated the First Amendment, and though it was later repealed, it illustrates the ever-present tension in U.S. history between freedom of expression and censorship. As president, John Adams enthusiastically enforced the Sedition Act. It is ironic that this champion of unpopular causes, this defender of British soldiers involved in the Boston Massacre, would have persecuted dissent with such energy. While much later in life he said he regretted doing so in his correspondence with Thomas Jefferson, Adams nevertheless believed that enforcement of the Sedition Act was for a greater good, the preservation of a very precarious union of the former colonies. Adams was neither the first nor the last to sacrifice principle on the frantically perceived excuse of necessity. Nor was the Sedition Act the only or latest action of the federal government to curtail liberty when faith in the concept has been tested. In 1962, in the case of Engel versus Vitale, Justice Hugo Black wrote, and I quote, "The history of governmentally established religion, both in England and in this country, showed that wherever government had allied itself with one particular form of religion, the inevitable result had been that it had incurred the hatred, disrespect, and even contempt of those who held contrary beliefs." End of quote. For this reason, the framers of the Bill of Rights forbade the establishment by the federal government of any particular religion. It cannot be supposed that those framers would have agreed that a book should be censored because it contained profane or dissident statements. Even more so, the very notion of punishing blasphemy as a federal crime was anathema to them. One's religion is orthodoxy for one and blasphemy for another. The founding fathers were not theocratic sectarians. An influential number of them were deists and probably closet agnostics. They were, moreover, avid students of John Locke, and though sharply divided on many other issues, were united in a rational libertarian philosophy, particularly as applied to the federal government rather than the several states. Most of the states had their own official religions and their own active censorship of books and ideas deemed unacceptable to their dominant religious establishments. Each of the original 13 states prosecuted libel, and all had laws criminalizing blasphemy or profanity or both. But there was no national consensus. What was profane, blasphemous, or obscene in one state was not necessarily so in another. It was not until 1925, in the case of Gitlow versus New York, that the Supreme Court decided the First Amendment's protections and guarantees would apply to the individual states as well as the federal government. The balance between restraint of expression and liberty would thereafter have a federal constitutional bedrock. The framers' libertarian philosophy was perhaps best expressed by John Stuart Mill in his essay on liberty. According to Mill's conception, liberty refers primarily to a condition characterized by the absence of coercion or constraint imposed by others. A person is said to be free or at liberty to the extent that he or she can choose goals or courses of conduct, can choose between available alternatives, and is not compelled to think or act or speak or prevented from acting, thinking, or speaking by the will of another, of the state, or of any other authority. In Mill's apt phrase, No individual should be a victim of, quote, the tyranny of the majority. Now, I think, parenthetically, it is perhaps noteworthy that Mill's notorious and lengthy adulterous relationship with a married woman prompted this essay. While these aspects of personal freedom have gained a secure toehold in our jurisprudence, obscenity has been excluded from the freedom of expression by the simple expedient of asserting that it is not protected speech at all. The goal of the courts has not been to legitimize obscenity, but rather to define it in such a way that it is not regarded as speech, thereby skirting around the First Amendment. Precisely what constitutes obscenity has bedeviled both the strongest and the weakest judicial minds for more than a century. In fact, some have argued that obscenity should not be condemned because the impossibility of formulating a definition that is not impermissibly vague or overly broad. Now, let me tell you a few things about the law of obscenity. I have never presided over an obscenity case as a judge because such cases are now rarely filed. My next remarks will shed some light on why that is so. Before 1973, obscenity cases were brought with some regularity. More than one crusading district attorney saw the political advantages in representing the morally upright and pursuing obscenity cases with a vengeance. Under those circumstances, it's a different part of the anatomy that's upright than one's morals. Now, we need to trace the development of the law that put the quietus to such a campaign. The 1868 case of Regina versus Hicklin judged obscenity by the mere effect of an isolated excerpt upon particularly susceptible persons. Typical of English cases, these concerns were class-based. What was suitable reading for the lord of the manor had to be shielded from the butlers and the chambermaids. Tradesmen simply couldn't be exposed to livid sexuality which would endanger their immortal souls. American courts initially adopted this standard, but later decisions, being more egalitarian, rejected it and substituted a test of whether to the average person, applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the material taken as a whole appeals to prurient interest. Prurient interest was defined as material having a tendency to excite lustful thoughts, or as Charles Rimbar, who successfully challenged the banning of Lady Chatterley's Lover, Tropic of Cancer, and Fanny Hill, said, pornography is in the groin of the beholder. Theodore Dreiser's An American Tragedy, published in 1925, was held to be lewd and obscene in Massachusetts in 1930. The Commonwealth's highest court held that, quote, even assuming great literary excellence, artistic worth, and an impelling moral lesson in the story, the book must still be banned. There are no lurid scenes in Dreiser's novel, but a young working-class man impregnates a fellow assembly line worker, and when she insists that he marry her, though he has abandoned the relationship for another with a wealthy socialite, he takes her on a boating trip and she drowns. He is tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. The Massachusetts court did not address the issue, but one has the lingering suspicion that Dreiser's socialist commentary about the wealthy class was the elephant on the courtroom floor. 4 years later, the federal courts in New York held that James Joyce's Ulysses was not obscene. Ulysses carries certain distinctions. Many literary critics consider it to be the greatest novel of the 20th century. Other than the Bible, it is probably read less and quoted more than any other book. Reading it is a daunting undertaking, and the casual reader will not find it worth the candle. But for the literati, one who reads it walks on holy ground once more. There are two classic judicial opinions in United States versus Ulysses. The first, at the district court level by Judge Woolsey, is the most famous, and the second, in the Court of Appeals by Judge Augustus Hand, is the better reasoned. Both were able to conclude that Ulysses was not really lustful. Judge Hand wrote, and I quote, "The erotic passages are submerged in the book as a whole and have little resultant effect." Judge Woolsey opined that the book was, quote, "emetic, not aphrodisiac." As our friend Charles Rembar observed, quote, "The implication, of course, is that the book was not likely to promote sin because nausea is not immoral." The significance of the Ulysses opinions is that they are based on literary analysis of the novel in its entirety rather than the previous Pecksniffian method of selecting isolated parts and instances of ostensibly obscene description. After Ulysses, courts employed various standards to determine exactly what was obscene. People versus Weplow, a 1947 California case, held that if the material has a substantial tendency to deprave or corrupt its readers by inciting lascivious thoughts or arousal of lustful desires, it is obscene. In Butler versus Michigan, a 1957 decision by Justice Frankfurter, who's ordinarily not known for a sense of humor, had this to say. Michigan had attempted to outlaw all printed matter that would, quote, "corrupt the morals of youth." An adult sold a book containing sexually explicit material to an undercover police officer. Justice Frankfurter noted the purchaser was also an adult, and children had nothing to do with the transaction. In overturning Michigan's law, he described it as having the practical effect of limiting adults to reading only what was fit for children. That, he wrote, quote, "was to burn the house to roast the pig." That's the funniest that Frankfurter ever got. The seminal case of Roth versus United States, which I mentioned earlier, was also decided in 1957. Two booksellers, Roth in New York and Alberts in Los Angeles, had been convicted under state and federal obscenity laws of mailing obscene flyers and advertisements through the U.S. mail. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld their convictions, ruling that obscenity was not protected by the First Amendment. The difficulty in defining obscenity was expressed by Justice Potter Stewart in 1964 in his now famous dictum in Jacobellis versus Ohio, and I quote, "I shall not attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so. But I know it when I see it, and the motion picture involved in this case is not that." Other justices apparently agreed, because starting in 1967 in Redrip versus United States, and for the next 6 years, the Supreme Court overturned 30 obscenity cases without written opinions. Now, for those of you who are not lawyers or judges, unwritten rulings are not the high watermark of an enlightened jurisprudence. Starting with Regina versus Hicklin, most of the obscenity trials had included expert testimony from recognized authorities in the field. The test could have been embraced by Justice Stewart, and it would be this: does the offending material contained in the work serve any purpose other than or in addition to inciting lascivious thoughts? If the answer is yes, it is protected expression because its other purpose has social value. This is perhaps an unduly elitist view, which was succinctly stated by that Harvard mathematician and songwriter Tom Lehrer in his famous song Be Prepared when he wrote, "Don't write naughty words on walls if you can't spell." I must digress to tell you about my first contact with Lady Chatterley's lover. In 1956, one of my undergraduate majors was English literature, and I was writing a paper about D.H. Lawrence and his treatment of social classes in England. Most of Lawrence's novels and short stories are readily available, but Lady Chatterley, then banned, was kept in the rare books room of the Norland Library at Boulder, and special permission was required to enter that sanctum sanctorum. I obtained the necessary note from my professor, who sneered at all forms of censorship, and marched in with a sense of authority and importance. The librarian looked at the note and she said, "Very well, but why couldn't you write a paper about T.E. Lawrence instead of D.H. Lawrence? You seem like such a nice boy." That was the first I had ever heard of T.E. Lawrence, and later I learned that this was the famous Lawrence of Arabia. In 1973, the Supreme Court of the United States decided Miller versus California and established a three-tiered test to determine what was obscene and thus not protected versus what was merely erotic and thus protected by the First Amendment. Under Miller, three requirements must be met for material to be deemed obscene. First, the material must appeal to the average person's prurient interest, applying contemporary community standards. Second, it must be patently offensive. But what is patently offensive as distinguished from, say, subtly offensive? Of one thing we can be fairly sure: the community standards of Las Vegas, assuming there are any, would not be the same as those of Des Moines, Iowa, or Paducah, Kentucky. If this sort of local option were the only criterion, it would be impossible to publish a book that would not be banned someplace in this country. But adding the third prong of the test, that the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, as a practical matter, renders anti-obscenity laws incapable of enforcement, because it requires the prosecution to prove a negative. And that is a daunting task at best, and for logical purists, it's an impossible one. Miller against California has not been overruled, but later cases chewed away at its edges. In the 1974 case of Jenkins versus Georgia, for example, the court ruled there are limits on what a state may deem to be patently offensive. The movie involved was Carnal Knowledge, starring Jack Nicholson and Anne Margaret, not exactly a Debbie Does Dallas sort of porno film. The court held the film could not be considered obscene because, quote, "there is no exhibition whatever of the actor's genitals, lewd or otherwise. There are occasional scenes of nudity, but nudity alone is not enough to make material legally obscene under the Miller standards." It continued, "The film could not, as a matter of constitutional law, be found to depict sexual content in a patently offensive way, and there is therefore, and is therefore not outside the protection of the First and 14th Amendments because it is obscene." Now, I respectfully suggest to the Supreme Court that exhibiting Jack Nicholson in the nude might be patently offensive. Finally, according to the Miller Doctrine, for material to be obscene, it must be taken as a whole and lack serious redeeming, artistic, literary, political, or scientific value. In Pope versus Illinois, a 1987 decision, the Supreme Court held that social value is to be determined not by a particular community standard, but by a national standard. Even more forcefully, the same national standard would necessarily have to be applied to scientific value and to artistic, literary, and political values as well. The court said, and I quote, "the value of a work does not vary from community to community. The proper inquiry is whether a reasonable person would find such value in the material." I think this Miller test pretty well explains why prosecutors no longer file obscenity cases. Early on, I indicated that I would add a few comments about child pornography. Its manufacture, distribution, or possession constitute serious crimes, not because of the focus on prurient interest or even that child pornography is obscene, which it most certainly is by any standard, but rather, in New York versus Ferber, a 1982 case, the Supreme Court held that the government may prohibit the exhibition, sale, or distribution of child pornography even if it does not meet the test for obscenity because, and I quote, "it is evident beyond the need for elaboration that a state's interest in safeguarding the physical and psychological well-being of a minor is compelling. The use of children as subjects of pornographic materials is harmful to the physiological, emotional, and mental health of the child," end of quote. The court said that child pornography is closely related to child abuse because children are harmed by the permanent record of their involvement in pornography, and they are exploited in the making of pornography. These criminal statutes relate to the depiction of children, whether by photograph, drawing, cartoon, sculpture, painting, or video. Legislation also forbids computer-generated human images and states it is not a required element that the minor depicted actually exist. As such, obscenity is not the basis, or as we say in law, the gravamen of the offense. Rather, it is the violence and permanent damage inflicted on children that is so pernicious as to warrant criminal sanction. The distinction is clear, and the prohibition of child pornography is fully justified without any reference at all to freedom of expression or personal liberty. While I have never been assigned an obscenity case, I have had numerous child pornography cases. Even for a First Amendment groupie, child pornography presents no challenge to the freedom of expression. The deliberate subjugation of children to pain, degradation, and humiliation is not a matter of expression, artistic or otherwise. It is an assault, a physical and psychological beating, and the science is clear and uncontradicted that each depiction, each showing, each viewing of the acts causes new and additional injury to the child. In the arena of legislation, adult pornography and films may be the next frontier, where actual victims, rather than tasteless thoughts, are given primary consideration. Judicial banning of books seems to have run its course. Banning books by school boards, religious and evangelical organizations will continue, and literary works such as Huckleberry Finn and Uncle Tom's Cabin will be clobbered by those who insist their taste and judgment is paramount, however ill-considered. Balances will need to be struck and outrage expressed, and the sinister hand of the censor will continue to place his imprint on the work of others. We are in a time, however, when the banning of books will not be afforded the unwarranted dignity of justice. For that, we can be grateful. Justice Potter Seward summed it up well when he said, "Censorship reflects society's lack of confidence in itself. So it is that the Constitution protects coarse expression as well as refined, and vulgarity no less than elegance." Thank you. Thank you.
Questions? Comments?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Judge Kane, by way of preface, the director, Oliver Stone, said, "Once one loses one's principles, one's lost the war." I have a two-part question. I'll attempt to be brief.
All right.
I'd like your thoughts on the legitimacy of my strong feeling that over the past decade or so, that some very strong foundational documents, particularly the Constitution and the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments, have essentially been deconstructed in this country. That's my belief. That's the first thing I'd like to hear your thoughts on. The second is, given the current Attorney General's unwillingness to roll back some very dubious legal opinions that were offered by the lawyers of the previous administration, what would you recommend that we, the citizens of the United States, do to regain our foundational document for this country?
Well, the first thing I have to tell you is that as a judge, I take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. One of those is that I don't get involved in politics. I have political views, but I'm not permitted to share them. I will say that I think your reference to Oliver Stone's comment is directly in point. and that in the last, I would suggest, the last 30 years, our nation has lost its moral compass, and we are really at sea without any sense of firm direction in how where we are going, and we lack the ballast of our fundamental documents in our jurisprudence. I think there are many, many causes for that, and they're not all political. A considerable amount of it, I think, has to do with the glut of information that well-intended men and women on the bench are trying to deal with and make sense of. I think also, and this may be entirely romantic in my view, but I do think that for those of us old enough to remember the end of World War II and the ensuing Cold War, that we lived constantly with a state of the risk of annihilation of our society. And we gave up certain principles at that point, too. I think, frankly, we had noble principles and a noble generation to overcome the Depression and to go into World War II. That's not a new thought with me, but I think it was there. But I think we lost a sense of direction with the Cold War. We got into the insanity of McCarthyism, and we ended up engaged in military conquest that we had no business being into. So I think when you look at the lack of moral fiber, it is not unusual or deviant for the legal system to reflect the same sort of thing. Now, as to the Attorney General of the United States, I've never met one that I liked. So, irrespective of any political party.
I wasn't fond of John Mitchell either.
Well, no, yeah. Well, but I don't think...
I recognize that you made a very good point that this expanded on some thoughts that I've had, is this just didn't start with the 21st century. It's been going on...
It's been going on a long time.
For a long time.
Yeah, and it's going to take something more than simply the law to right itself. It's going to take people who are going to be willing to express themselves and their sense of outrage, and thank God that there's such a thing like community radio to provide that opportunity. Yes, sir.
Thanks. Kind of a constitutional question. You brought up religion and the connection there with politics and obscenity. I'm curious about the Establishment Clause. And if in the most basic sense, the government's not to establish religion, yet there are approved religions that have tax-free status. If I want to put a colander on my head and be a pastafarian, though, no can do. So it seems by definition the government is the one establishing what is religion. When Mormonism started, it was a cult. Now it's a religion.
Well, it's a cult that succeeded where a lot of other cults at the same time didn't. You know, they had I love their song, but what was the women that lived in upstate New York and didn't have sex? The Shakers? It was the men that were shaking, I think. But then, but they were at that same time. There was the Oneida group that believed in free love, and they failed. So the Mormon church was the one that was of cults that was able to succeed at that time, and I think the reason it did, frankly, is because they were persecuted and eventually got to the state of Utah, and there wasn't anybody there to persecute them. So they were able to exist under those circumstances. Scientology has been regarded as a cult, but has fought for many, many years to become recognized as a religion, and to the point that even the Internal Revenue Service now says that it is. So I think that, you know, a cult is somebody else's religion which hasn't been established.
And what established?
Custom. Enough people doing it.
Does the government recognize it?
Well, that's an That's a very complicated, it's an easy question and it requires a complicated answer. But the fact is that every single colony had an official religion. Every single one of them did. And it was against, they persecuted people who did not conform to their religion, with the exception of Pennsylvania. And that's because it was founded by the Quakers, but they needed, it was such a huge place, they had to bring in all different kinds of people, and they started principally with Germans, and so they had Lutherans, and then the German dissidents who came in, Mennonites and the Amish and so forth, and so they recognized them, but that was the only state that did. The other states all had official religions, and they persecuted other people. What the founding fathers were concerned with is they didn't want whoever was in control, such as the Federalists, of the federal government to pronounce that there was a national federal religion. But when you look at the Bill of Rights and the history of it being passed, they weren't anti-religious. They were anti-federal religion to eliminate or compete with others. We've gone into a different, evolved into a different way of looking at religion now. But, I have my own views on that. I think that evangelical religion is essentially a demonstration of a great need for certainty in a very uncertain world. And that's my, view for which I would have been burned at the stake in some places for saying so.
I kind of like to tie two threads here together, the moral flabbiness and the First Amendment, because one of the scariest things that I thought with the 9/11 incident was a poll taken afterwards that indicated that over half of the people would be willing to trade their First Amendment rights for security. Mm-hmm. And one could easily imagine another incident coming along, even bigger, that would promote that. And I was just, from your perspective, do you feel like our judicial system could stand up to a strong majority pressure to override the First Amendment in the name of security?
Unfortunately, I do. Yeah. Let me tell you why. I don't think all judges would, by any means. But as an overall system, there's an incredible amount of pressure to substitute thinking with systems. And people who are in these jobs, I'm a senior judge. I've got a really nice life because I don't have to take any cases I don't want to. I can't pick the case I want to take, but I'm in the draw, and if I look at one and I say, God, I don't want to listen to that guy again, I can send it back. Or if I say, I used to love Title VII cases that dealt with discrimination, but now it's one of these, he pinched me on the ass in the warehouse and I want $1 million, and I don't want to mess with that anymore. So I just send those back. But an active judge doesn't have that right. An active judge has to take whatever cases are assigned, and it doesn't take that much to file a suit. So what happens is that people devise systems with computers, et cetera, to substitute for individual thinking. And we've done that in the criminal law with sentencing, where everything goes on a matrix. And you don't have to stay up all night and sweat blood thinking what you're going to do in a case to render a just verdict. It's all programmed into a matrix. I don't use it. But most judges that are alive today practicing, or actually, it's not, we don't practice. Most judges alive who are judging today never sentenced any other way. The system started in 1988. So you have to look at older judges who were in experience before 1988 that have that experience of sentencing without using these mandatory guidelines. Where else but in Washington would you come up with an oxymoron like mandatory guideline? But that's what it is. And the same thing is true with the way that civil cases are handled now. And there is a diffusion of responsibility where we now have more, almost, we have almost as many magistrate judges as we do judges under Article 3 of the Constitution. That wouldn't be a bad thing, except that what happens now is the Article 3 judges get a case and they immediately refer it to the magistrate. And so they're trying to process rather than adjudicate. Now, under those circumstances, if somebody wants to come out and say, under the Patriot Act, that you can have wiretaps without accountability, without probable cause, and so on, all you have to do is say, national security. But what's to change the law from using national security as the grounds for these kinds of groundless warrants and wiretaps and so forth, to include something else? Drugs would be the next one. Then money laundering, which would, of course, never apply to Wall Street. But you can understand that it would expand. And you're asking, a judge, does he have the, or she, have the wherewithal to look at this avalanche of material coming in saying, I've got to do something on all of these cases. I say no to this one. Oliver Stone is prophetic. Yes?
I think we've got time for one more.
There's a young man out there that wants to say something.
Hi, as you were talking about the legal rationale for child pornography, which I understood to be the subjugation of a certain population, the ongoing violence perpetrated, it made me think of hate speech. And why doesn't that same legal rationale apply to hate speech?
It does. It's a crime to engage in hate speech. It isn't protected because it's not regarded in law as speech. It goes back to a quotation from in an opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, considered one of the greatest of our judges in American history, who said, "No one has the right to shout fire in a crowded theater. It's not the words themselves; it's what the words themselves do that are so predictable as to create an imminent danger, and that's how you do that." The rationale for child pornography not being speech is something else, and that is because we're not even concerned with the expression of it, but rather with the effects upon the children. I've had a number of these cases, and I don't want to dwell on them, but I can tell you this, that young girls who are filmed in child pornography throughout the world, the chances are that 85% of them are either going to end up committing suicide or as prostitutes. That's the kind of thing that happens as a result of that. So we're not dealing with expression, and that's the way that the change is made.
Okay. Thank
you, Your Honor. You've alluded with reference to obscenity, how social mores have changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
In view of precedents setting guidelines for the judiciary to decide, how much of a hindrance is that as things change for a member of the judiciary to be on the cusp and come up with a new decision? And secondly, how much of a stricture is the fear of being overturned on appeal to prevent that type of decision?
Well, those are two questions with two totally different answers. I think precedent applies in this about the same way as speed limits on a highway do for the average driver. You look at them and you say, if I go beyond that, I'm going to get a ticket. It's going to be dangerous, and I shouldn't do it. And I think a judge looks and says, I've been a judge for 35 years, and I think I've had maybe four cases or what are called first impression that nobody ever decided them before. The rest of the time, I'm trained to look at the precedents and see what they are. And it means a lot to me to do that. I believe that the black robe a judge wears is a symbol of anonymity. And it isn't so much my decision as it is what my determination is what the law is. And I think when judges go beyond that, they get into a lot of difficulty. The Supreme Court of the United States is something else because it's not really a court of law. It's a court of politics and policy. And they pronounce it, and we have to do what we can with it. It's not always easy. As to the fear of reversal, I have to tell you that there's a number of ways in which a judge is reversed or affirmed. I've been affirmed when I was wrong. I've been reversed when I was right. I've been affirmed when I was right, and I've been reversed when I should have been. We disagree about those things, and it's an area where reasonable minds can differ. So when I get reversed on a case I really believe in, I say, I wasn't wrong, I was outvoted. But you just keep on going, because I think the law does give us a stability that otherwise we wouldn't have.